Okay, welcome, folks, to another episode of The Suspendables. This is number 19, and everyone says Larry Robinson, great player with the Montreal Canadiens. Coming up on today's show, it never disappoints. We got to talk to Rusty about his days in New York, about how come coaches don't make a very good player. This is absolutely the best answer I've ever heard from Russ on that topic. How about this? He was going to run for Parliament. You're going to hear that. Mark Messier, one of the greatest guys ever. He comes up again in the show, which is really cool. And Russ tells him, well, you got to hear his opinion at the end of the show about Matt Cook. Stay tuned. That and a lot more. Stick around on The Suspendables. Boom! That's the starting pistol, and they're off. Hi again, everybody. It's Jungle Jim Jerome here, and Russ Courtnell coming at you with episode 19. Rusty, wow. Episode 9. Who was your of the Suspendables? Thanks everyone for tuning in. Who was your favorite 19?
Larry Robinson.
I can guess. Larry Robinson. He's everyone's favorite 19. Iconic defenseman with the Montreal Canadiens. What are you doing? What's going on? Let's catch up.
Well,
it's another week gone
I'm,
by.
I'm headed to New York City tomorrow morning with Paris and
sure. Your wife.
Yeah, early morning flight, 7 a.m. So that'll be nice. Early wake up call.
What's going on?
We're going with Roberto and Deanna Aquilini, owners of the Canucks, the Aquilini family. They're opening a restaurant in New York City. It's not opening next Sunday, but they are opening. A little premature, but the Canucks play on Sunday, so we're going to the game, and then we're having a little tasting party before it opens. You know how that works—the tasting party, so you can go through the menus and stuff.
I don't, Russ. But.
Okay. Well, they're having a tasting party, and so the Canucks are going to go and. Paris and I are going to go. We're hanging out for the week and we're just going to chill. We're going to walk. We're going to shop. We're going to eat. We're going to drink. And hopefully squeeze in some workouts.
You know, the prince and the princess of wherever they are, okay, in England, okay, they probably don't do the same things you do. You know, you know, the queen and her husband are probably going, hey, how about these guys are living higher in the hog than we are. What the fuck's going on here? I love your stories. I really do. You know, and you talk like, hey, everybody's doing that every Friday. What's up with us for the weekend? Well, on Friday, Jimmy, we're getting on a plane. We're going to go to New York. Oh, the Big Apple, of course, sure, because LA is a little boring right now. And we're going to hang out with the owners of the Canucks. And then Jimmy, of course, what everyone does is they go to high-end restaurant tasting parties. Fuck. Have you ever lived? Is this the only way you live all the time? Have you ever cut your own grass? Have you ever
I did. I told the story when Stephen Harper called me to run for the MP for my community in Victoria. I was cutting the lawn. Remember that? And he called the house and Paris goes, okay, Stephen Harper. And he was so serious and
wow,
professional. And he called to see if I would run for, what was it? Oak Bay, Victoria. Wow. I should know it. But anyways, we had a 46-minute conversation about running and what it would be like to be in Ottawa and kids. It was a great conversation, but of course I didn't run.
Was it going to be no all the way? So you had the prime minister phone, you ask you to run as an MP. Coincidentally, the election starts next month, or the election is next Monday here in Canada. So tell me about that conversation. Were you a definite no, or did he try and sway you and you almost thought about it, or what?
I thought about it for about a week, went to a couple events for the Conservative Party and introduced some of their people, and I really dug into it. The reason I didn't do it was I was going to have to live in Ottawa minimum 26 weeks a year. And it was so funny in the conversation, because I was telling him, I was saying to Stephen Harper, that if I win, then I'd like to be in back in Victoria. And he goes, oh, that's funny, because most MPs, we can't get them out of Ottawa and back to their constituents because they want my job. All they want to do is run the country instead of their community. But we had a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking to him. It's the only time I've ever spoken to him. It was that one time he called me and asked if I would run. And I've obviously seen him on TV and different events, but I've never, ever spoken to him. And he's a big hockey fan, as we all know in Canada.
Right.
And our kids are the same age. We have boys that were the same age. So we were talking hockey, and he was saying, would you play on the on our hockey team in Ottawa? And I was like, for sure. And he goes, oh my God, the guys are so excited that you might, you know, if you win, then you'd be playing on their team. And, you know, in Canada, that's what, you know, we're all about our hockey. And so we talked about family, we talked about community, we talked about the country. It was great. I loved it. And, but unfortunately, just the timing for me and my life and family, it just didn't work out. And who knows if I would have won or not, but in our community, at that point, we just raised a bunch of money that we've talked about for mental health. And so I think the conservatives or any political party just saw an opportunity that I was in good standing with our community, ex-professional athlete. Anyways, and it was interesting to me. I was definitely nervous about doing it, because I don't know a lot about politics, but I know a lot about my community and the needs and wants of people that live there. So that part would have been easy. The hard part would have been debating and knowledge of things that, you know, the shit you know about from your dad that I don't know.
Listen, Russ, there would have been, I got lots to say about this because my dad was a member of parliament, right? So I'm just, when you say there's a lot of things that I'd be uncomfortable with, you know, the debating, I get that. That'd be tough. You know, it'd be a lot of stress, you know, if somebody had to answer. The other thing, Russ, would be, oh, I don't know, working 8 hours a day. You know, calling in from, well, I'm in Miami this weekend. Sorry, I can't be in there for question period. I won't be able to do that. But you know what? You said something interesting, because we don't talk politics here on the show too much. And I've begun to hate politics. My father was a member of parliament in the 70s. And when you said, I know a lot about my community and I know about the needs and wants of your constituency in Victoria or Oak Bay, you know, that's the way it was sort of back in the 70s, that MPs looked after their own ridings and stuff. And it's just, there's so much shit now about people calling each other out and I hate you and you don't know what you're doing. And on that point, you know, I got to say hello to one of my longtime, in fact, he was a campaign manager of my dad's, turned 80 years old, and I heard from, and he's a big fan of the show. He's up in Sudbury, Dan Newell and his wife, Shirley. He turned 80 this week. So anyway, well, that's interesting.
I never knew that. If he worked for your dad, he must have three livers.
Yeah, he does. I'll tell you how fucking hilarious those people were, though, Russ. So when my dad was speaker, he invited a bunch of his buddies, you know, like you would, you know, for his swearing in down in Ottawa. And these guys were so hilarious. And it was very formal. It was a big dinner. And this Danny Newell had the guys who were serving dinner, right? He had them just in stitches when one of the waiters came by and showed him the wine. And Danny pulled them aside, you know, and flipped them 20 and said, listen, bring out the good shit. Okay. it's stuff that your buddies would have done too, you know, and he pretending he was stealing silverware and shit like that. It was hilarious back in the day. But anyway, so you're off to New York. Cool. We've got another week in the books, hockey wise. And the talk of the league is the Edmonton Oilers right now.
Oh, nobody likes a bragger.
Yeah, I'm bragging. I live here in Edmonton.
I think it's great. I mean, Edmonton has probably the best player in the league or in the world, or one of top five, I guess. The story I love about Edmonton right now is James Neal. It's my favorite. Oh, yeah. It's the comeback kid. I love the story. You know, the kid, he had a great career going, and then last year, boom, fell on his face in Calgary. He gets traded, which never, it's like that stuff never ever happens where you trade in your province. Like, you know, it just rarely ever happens that you make the trade between Edmonton and Calgary. You probably can look them up how many trades they've made back and forth, and they're probably minor, minimal, crappy deals that nobody really noticed. But
right.
this could end up being one of the best trades of all time. And I love Lucic. I think he's also, you know, another guy that didn't have a great year last year and has struggled. Mm-hmm. And always liked him as a player. So there's nothing against him. It's all about James. And gosh, he's just off to a fantastic, I mean, it's a career start for him. Forget about all the other years he played. This is probably the best start he's ever had.
I'll tell you what, Russ. Not only is it a career start for him, but if you look at his numbers, I think he's got seven goals now. That would be a career start for a lot of guys, for anybody.
Well, I think it's a better start than anyone's had in Edmonton history.
I think you're right. And along with that, the Oilers are 5-0. They're about to tee off here in about a half an hour as we record this. Recording Monday night because yesterday was the holiday or Thanksgiving.
Today is officially. Fuck, can we talk about that for a second and then don't lose your train of thought? But, you know, can't we celebrate Thanksgiving on Thanksgiving? It's always like Sunday night, the night before. It'd be like in the United States, instead of Thursday, they'd have it on Wednesday night. It doesn't happen.
You know, when you say that, okay, this is what I think of your opinion on that, okay? The holiday, when people get all revved up for New Year's, every night for you, Russ, is a holiday. Every night is Friday night, okay? Every freaking night. I can't believe you. It should be the Monday because I work so hard all week. Shut up.
My buddy, Jason Woodbridge, founder and owner of 100 Acre Wine, amazing wine. He told me, he said, Russ, every day is Friday. Every night is Friday night. And Saturday is New Year's Eve.
Yeah, right. I know that to be true with you.
Well, it's like guys who say, let's go for one beer. Like, hey, how about we meet for a beer? I'm like, that just doesn't happen. Who goes up for one beer?
Yep. Listen, my old man used to have the greatest. He'd walk into the bar. You know, because everyone would say just one. And my dad would say, okay, just one, two after that. I'll have a couple more and then a third and then one more. And then I got to fuck off. I think I've told that story before. Anyway, I want to ask you, do you like Don Cherry? And of course you're a good friend of Ron
McLean.
Ron McLean. And for those of you who have been living in the dark, those guys now have been doing that gig between periods, Grapes and Ron McLean, for like well over 30 years now, that stuff. And Grapes is still there. He's into his 80s and still doing it. And everyone's trying to kill him on it every once in a while. But I think he's great. I love him, even as animated as he can be, even when he makes mistakes. But you brought up James Neal, and Ronnie McLean asked Donnie what he thinks of that. And Don Cherry said he thinks the reason Neal is playing so well is because he's a star. He always believed that. And he thinks he should have been treated better in Calgary. And he thinks the turnaround is that the coach and the GM in Edmonton are treating him like a star. And I wanted your thoughts on that. Do you have to treat guys differently? And what do you think of that take by Don Cherry saying they're treating him like a star? They didn't do it in Calgary. And look what's happening.
Well, coming from Gretz this summer, when we talked about it, he talked about the trade and he was bullish on the trade. He loved it. And he said that James Neal told the team that he's going to come to camp in better shape than he's ever been. And he wants to prove everybody wrong. And he thanked them for the trade. So if a kid comes out of the block saying that to a coach and a GM, how do you not treat him any differently? He's a proven player in the league. And let him do what he does. You got to put players and people, it doesn't matter if it's in sport, in life, you have to put people in a position where they can succeed. There's a kid with special needs and I'm not going to bring up his name, but his dad owns a bunch of hotels in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I got to know the family, and he's in charge of the, one of the hotels, he's in charge of the waste of garbage. Right. And he freaking runs that thing like nobody's business, and everybody thanks him, and he's thriving because that's what he can do and that's what he's best at. So people just need to be in a position where with their talent they can succeed. And trying to fit players into, and back to hockey, trying to fit a player into a position where he's not going to, how is he going to succeed if he's with two checkers and he's a sniper? I mean, he might get the odd chance. I mean, I played with Dan Balzman. His idea of a pass was high and hard off the glass, and we'd just chase right. the puck all the time. And when I played with Guy Carboneau and Mike McPhee and Neil Broughton and even Trevor Linden in Vancouver, we were the checking line. But when we got the puck, we tried to keep it and tried to score. Mm-hmm. And so if you put Neil with a bunch of hackers that are just going to shoot it off the glass, dump it in and change, how is he going to succeed? So that's just my personal opinion.
Right. So what you're saying is he's got to be coached properly, right? He's got to be put with the right guys and all that stuff.
Right.
But in this case, Russ, I guess the question is, can you destroy a guy's ability because you don't handle him properly?
100%.
Like, go ahead, talk about 100%. That.
100%. I mean, coaches ruin players every year. I mean, there's great players that just mentally couldn't handle it because, or they just weren't given the opportunity. If a coach doesn't like a person, he's the player's screwed pretty much, unless they're so good that it doesn't matter. But generally, if you call up a player and because the GM wants to see him, the coach doesn't like him, the GM's up in the little box up there watching, and the guy starting the engine, has the keys to the player, is behind the bench. Marcus Naslin,
right?
They tried to trade him,
right?
So when he first got there, they were going to, it didn't work out. And then Keenan came in and he was going to get rid of him. So in order to get anything for him, they had to play him with Mess. And then he went out and scored two goals, and then he scored again, and then he scored again. And now he's Hall of Famer. I mean,
right.
But the coach didn't like him. The coach wanted to get rid of him. And then he put him in a position to succeed in order to trade him. And he played so well, they're like, oh, we can't trade him now. And he just got better, and he got better, and he got better, right. And then became the captain of the team. And he was like, he had one foot out the door. He was ready to go back to Sweden and play hockey.
Right.
I mean, he was done. He'd had it in Pittsburgh. He'd had it in Vancouver. And then everything turned around for him, and it was fantastic. But it happens all the time.
I've seen, when you bring up Messier, one of the big, and Mark was super funny, super engaging guy. Everyone knows the stories about him being one of the toughest guys out there, one of the greatest leaders of all time. And when you do talk about him being one of the greatest leaders, I've heard it time and time again that someone said, this guy can change a kid's life who comes in, who's feeling not so confident. You know, and feeling, with all these stars, particularly on the Oilers, and single-handedly Mess could pull the guy aside and pump him up like he was the captain of the team. And I wonder if you've, what your thought is on that, where a player can really change, in that case, you talk about Naslin who got paired up with Mess, who was a great star, but the power of positive thinking and all that stuff.
Well, you bring up Mess, who's just a different animal, because I've never seen a player that controlled a room like Mark. He coaches were intimidated by him. So if the coach tried to do anything to a player, which I've heard that they Keenan tried to do some stuff in New York, and Mark went in and just said, "You're not going to ruin this player. You know, fuck off and leave him alone and let him play." Wow. And yeah, exactly. And I don't know. I don't know of a player. I mean, maybe Bob Gainey could have done that in Montreal when I was there, probably. But Mess had that intimidation factor, not only with players, people, opponents, but I saw it in, with Colin Campbell when he coached us in New York, when he was showing us this, how we were going to play against New Jersey. And I'm playing for the New York Rangers at the time where we beat Florida. We're playing New Jersey, who was had more points than us. And he's trying to explain how we're going to play against them. And Mark gets up, grabs the pen out of his hand and goes, "Okay, this is how we're going to do it. Like this, like that, like this, like that. Okay, meeting's over." And we went out and won the freaking series. It was awesome.
But grabbed it right out of the coach's hand.
He went right up to the board and started, you know, explaining what Colin Campbell was trying to explain and none of us were getting. And he just simplified it and took over and goes, "Okay, we got it. Let's do it." And I actually went up to coach after that. And I asked him, "Do you really want me to do this?" And he goes, "Yeah, yeah, that's what I want you to do." And I go, "Okay." And frick, we went out and I think we beat them in 5 games.
Right.
It was awesome. Right. And Gretz had an unbelievable series. I mean, you know, the silent assassination of Wayne Gretzky. I mean, I can't remember how many goals he got in that series, but it was phenomenal. Like he was just like a young kid again. And but Mess has that intimidation with coaches, but I don't know any other player that does.
Well, or did. Mess was the epitome of the expression, "Take no prisoners," every single game. You know, I mean, he was, you know, I throw it out there all the time for questions with Russ. And one of them is, there's a hilarious guy at my Twitter. He's a fake Mike Babcock account, but he's a passionate hockey guy. And when you talk about Mess doing just what he did, that sounds like something that's in the past, you know, that there's not that much anymore of this. And Babs, they're the fake Mike Babs. He says, "Are the players, the superstars and all the players that we have now in the league, are they coddled too much by the coaches in the dressing room?" And he says, "I want it back to the 80s where they could take a prospect who is no good, kill him and get rid of him." And it has it changed, you know, is he saying those days are gone by where just what you explained, where Mess would get up and go, "Okay, fuck that. This is what we're going to do." Is it different now, coaching players, than in the old days?
The players that I know that play the game now tell me that it's a lot different, that the players got to be coddled and, you know, you can't be hard on them. And I've talked to a couple coaches that currently coach in the NHL, and they said it's just different. The kids are different. It's not, you just got to be, you know, how did they say it? They just, you know, they're not calling them weak or anything. They're just saying that they, you know, you've got to massage them a little bit more and be coddle them a little bit. And you can't, the yelling and screaming doesn't work anymore. Like, you know, the threatening, like John Brophy used to threat Steve Thomas. I told that line, like when Stumpy and I played in Toronto and he got called up, he wasn't playing well. And he got called up from St. Catharines, which is probably 30.
Stumpy is who? Sorry to interrupt.
Steve Thomas.
Okay.
So Stumpy, great goal scorer, really good guy, great player. And he just got called up and it's like 35 kilometers probably from St. Catharines. I don't know. It's not far from Toronto. And he goes, "It might be a," what did he say? "Stumpy, it might be an, hour drive up from St. Catharines, but it's 2 years going back or something." 2 years to get back here, something like that. It was like a short ride, 45 minute ride up, and two years to get back here if I send you down. And then Stumpy, I think, went out and scored 2 goals in the third period. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that happened. It was like guys would get sent down for just, you know, like, "Oh, you're going to the minors." You know, but the rules have changed now and you got to go through waivers and all that stuff. So teams have kind of lost their threat of sending you down. So you really got to work with them. And I really believe that all athletes want to go and do their best, and they want to be the best player they can be. It doesn't matter who you are. They want to go out and play well. Not too many guys want to just sit back and not play well. They just shit happens.
You would know, Russ, if you were going to be a coach when you left hockey, say right after you retired, you would probably have some idea how to coach guys, you know, because you played in the league. You were a big listener, used to try and get inside of the head of the coaches. You told us a couple episodes ago. Would you be able to coach today, Russ, if you thought of a style back then, say in the late 90s or something, would you be able to coach today? If you were in the league?
I think I would. I think that I love teaching. I'm a motivator. I love to see people succeed. I don't play favorites. Mm-hmm. And so I probably would be okay. There's a lot to it. It's not something I've coached, you know, minor hockey and stuff. And there's a lot to it. I'd probably be a better assistant coach because wouldn't be the head guy, and I could help out. Maybe teach a little more or a lot more, not being the head guy. But you play professionally for 16 years. I think you have something to offer, and it wouldn't be totally new for me.
Would you ever do it, Russ?
I've never.
Or someone asked you to do it.
I've been asked a couple times at a junior level and college level, but I've never ever put my name out. I mean, this is probably the first time I've ever talked about it publicly, but no, I never thought of it. I think I've said it on the show before that I thought I'd be better the front office.
Scalping tickets.
Yeah, management, some management or on the corporate side, business side of it, I'd probably be better.
So you said no? Someone asked you about coaching and you said
no? Yeah, I was thinking about it the other day. I initially was asked to do some TV stuff and I never thought I'd be good enough to do that. And then I start coaching my son and the biggest thing I ever did was I coached the in Davos at the Spangler Cup for Canada. I was assistant coach there, and I loved it. I loved being the assistant. I had a great time, but you know, it was only 2 weeks. So these guys, you know, you mentioned the 8-hour day, and these coaches put in a lot of hours, and that wouldn't as you alluded, that wouldn't be for me.
Yeah,
where's Coach Russ?
Yeah. Well, it's even mess, you know, where people said, we got to tap this guy on the shoulder to get him to be a GM of a team and all that. And even he said, you know what, the hours, and he's not afraid of hard work. There's no doubt about it, you know, but he said, it's just something that people are totally unfamiliar with. Kevin Lowe said, it's a 24/7 dude.
Yeah. Know? And I think they brought that on themselves. Not, I don't know who it was that thought you had to be at the rink like that all day long and breaking down this and breaking over. I think they just overanalyze, and I think it's too much, but
tell me this, Russ, this conversation comes up all the time. When speaking of coaching and former players, I don't know the exact numbers and I never would, but it's more often than not, Russ, that really good players in the NHL. There we go. What do we have in there? What is that?
White Claw.
Jesus.
Sorry.
I thought a gun went off. Was that a keg?
No.
Was that a keg you opened?
No.
Oh, sound like
12 ounces.
Jesus, I thought someone got snipered. Opening the can. But more often than not, Russ, really good players who were star players like yourself in the NHL, more often than not, they don't have very much success coaching. When they go into the, you know, we bring his name up all the time, of course, you know, even Wayne, didn't have a bunch of success coaching, and it certainly isn't because he didn't know the game, you know. And there's been other guys who go into the coaching after but don't. And whether you agree with that or not, or do you think you know why that might be the case?
I think that great players just play and it just comes so natural, and they can't teach it. And I think that the coach that was a grinder, who was up and down, and we all worked hard. Everybody worked hard, but they talk about these coaches that, you know, they didn't have it easy. They had to do this. They had to do that. I really, truly believe they really had to put a lot of thought into playing and how the game worked, and how they were going to stay in the game. And I think great players were so natural and so gifted, and they went out and they played, and they really didn't have to put a lot of thought into it. So for them to try to teach somebody, it's really difficult, where somebody who struggled to play at this level or at any professional level or even junior level, who really struggled, had to put a lot more thought into how the game works, and their knowledge of the game. A lot of times they have a lot more knowledge about the game because they sat back and watched where the best players played, and it's hard to put that into words of how to do that when you're Mark Messier, Wayne Gretzky, Guy Lafleur, Bobby Orr, Gordie Howe, you know, on and on and on. These guys just were so natural and so gifted that they didn't think, they just played.
Right. That might be the best answer I've ever heard for that question. Why a lot of players don't make, a lot of superstar players don't make good coaches. That point you made about, you know, a fourth liner really has to pay attention to systems and all that stuff.
Well, look at golf. I mean, all these guys who are on TV every Sunday, the best players in the world, they got some guy behind them. Mm-hmm. You don't know who they are until they, you know, coach Wayne or coach Tiger Woods or Dustin Johnson. Mm-hmm. You don't know who the fuck these guys are. And then you hear, oh yeah, that guy, he's from Toronto. He's the best putting coach in the world. Yet he cannot play on the tour. If he's that good, why is he not on TV on Sunday? So that's kind of the example I'm using, is somebody who struggled, but it wasn't good enough, had to learn every little bit of the stroke, the swing, the movement, but they can't put it together themselves to be the best. But here they are coaching the best freaking golfers in the world, and you don't know who the hell they are.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. You know, Joel Quenneville, Hitchcock, Scotty Bowman.
But Hitch's biggest thing was McDonald's. He just couldn't drive by a McDonald's without eating it.
But I'm telling you, know, just to your point, great Glenn Sather, right? All these guys were, but they were nobodies when they played hockey, right? They didn't light the world on fire.
John Cooper is probably the best coach in the NHL right now.
Yep. Tampa Bay.
He didn't play junior hockey. He played hockey growing up, but then played lacrosse at college. I mean, he's probably the best coach in the NHL. I mean, in my opinion, he's the best right now.
Right.
Didn't play junior hockey.
Yep. He wasn't very good in the first round last year, but
well, if you're not gonna win the cup, you go out quick.
You go up fast forward.
You got the whole summer ahead of you. No.
Speaking of lightning.
That was a crusher for a poor Johnny boy. Oh, I felt for him. Feel for him.
So someone has asked, I'm expanding on this question, with the new sticks, with the new rules, with the new way things are being coached, would have you scored more goals, Russ, now than you did back then?
I don't know about that. I mean, I definitely, the rules would have helped my game because I was a fast skater, but I don't know. I mean, there's nobody scoring more goals.
So when you say that, sorry to interrupt. When you say that, because you're a fast skater with the rules, that would have helped you.
For sure. What do you mean? For sure. There's no hooking. There's no holding. And, but my point about scoring more is, well, we scored more goals in the 80s than they're scoring now, and I played then, so why would I score more goals in this game? But I would definitely the rules would have helped me for sure. Would it help my stats? I don't know. I don't think, because look at, nobody's beating Gretz right now.
Right. Right. What are any of those records? You bring that up. Any of those you think will fall? This is always good fun.
If Ovechkin stays healthy, he probably will break Gretz's goals. He'll score more goals.
I almost get a feeling, Russ, that guy, most guys, when you're talking about records, they'll all say, I don't worry about that. I want to win the Stanley Cup, or I want to win. I'm almost getting the feeling, and I take nothing away from the guy, that he's shooting for that record.
Oh, for sure. He's a huge Wayne Gretzky fan. Mm-hmm. And he has that number in his head, and he still is a great team player. He's a great player. I love the way he plays, and he's going to play the same way, but he's going to try to get there. He's going to try to get there and break that record. Why wouldn't you? I mean, if you're going to do something, then, what a goal to have is to try to surpass Wayne. I mean, it's going to be awesome if he can do it. And Wayne will be the first person there to shake his hand. And I think Wayne has said that publicly, that if he does it, he'll be there to shake his hand, just as Gordie Howe was there, I think. Was Gordie there when Wayne broke it?
Oh,
I know
sure
his dad was.
Yeah, no, he followed him along. He started going to each city. Was he there on the night?
Not sure.
Because it was in Edmonton, because I think I was at the game when he broke it. Or playing against Edmonton, one of the two, which was totally cool. Any other record? Do you think anything else? Like, certainly that record, I agree. The Ovi one, I've been watching that for sure. When you think of the game today, which seems to be the theme of the game yesterday and the game today, do you see anything else going into the record books from the 80s or 90s?
Well, when we were during the lockout in 94 or 95, Gretz put together a team called the 99 All-Stars, and we were in Helsinki, and we were at a bar, and there was a barber chair, and they put you in this chair, and the record was 52 shots. And I bet you that record won't be broken.
Who took it? I don't know.
It was on the board, but I know Doug Wilson tried to break it. I think he got to 28 and then missed the team bus the next morning. He was our coach.
I did a podcast before this as a hobby, and Larry Robinson was one of my guests. I did one-on-one interviews with guys, and Larry was one of my guests. And I got to interview Semenk before he died, and Marty and Gretz and all these guys. And Larry Robinson was hands down one of the best storytellers I've ever had.
Oh yeah.
And I got to admit, Russ, he talked about playing hockey in the 70s, and the greatest stories he told were how hammered they used to get.
Oh.
Him and Guy Lafleur and a bunch of other guys, he told these great stories. Shit you would never even be able to tell these days. But that when you bring up who drank the most, those are some of the records that a lot of guys took claim to.
I played for the Montreal Canadiens, we were owned by the Molsons, Peter and John. And, we'd be on the team bus from the airport to downtown, whatever visiting city we were playing at. And there'd always be a Molson Brewery, the big red M lit up.
Sure.
And the bus, every time all the boys would give a standing ovation when we go by a Molson Brewery. It was so funny.
Salute. You'd have to get up and salute.
And the cool thing about Montreal back then was we were the only team that were allowed to drink in the hotel bar. I've told this story before or said this before.
I don't think so.
But we'd all check, go up to our rooms. You had a roommate back then. Now they don't have fucking roommates. apparently they all have their own room. Anyway, so we'd throw our bags in. The door would barely close. We would be out downstairs. And then the whole team would have a couple beers together, two or three. And then we'd all decide where we're going to eat. And we were so close because we met downstairs, hung out in the lobby bar. And most of the hotels we hung out at, the lobby bar sucked. It just, they had cold beer, cold drinks. So we'd meet down there, have a couple of drinks. And then we'd go out for dinner and come back and maybe have one or two more. And then the next day was game day. It was, but boy, oh boy, we had some fun. And when you're on a good team, the more fun it is, obviously winning, but the more fun the guys have too together. And, you know, when you're losing, everybody, you're under a microscope and not supposed to have any fun because you're losing. So it's tough when you're on a shitty team.
Right. I was drinking in a lobby bar in Montreal, a little boutique hotel, you know, where the lobby bar is like right at the front desk. Yeah. Almost. It was kind of cool. And I was there with Eddie and Wayne and Glennie Gretzky. And we went down to Montreal from Ottawa. And and Wayne went upstairs, you know, he had to go make a few calls. We were having a couple of pints.
Before cell phones.
Before cell phones, he had to go up to the room and make a call. And there was a chick in there. To make a long story short, speaking of fun back in the days, I had convinced her, Russ, to let me put on her dress. Okay? And so we went in the bathroom and we exchanged clothes.
No. No.
We did. We did. And I put this tight red dress on. I was fucking hammered.
Oh, geez.
And I came out to the lobby and I sat back in my same seat. And I thought, what's – Gretz might go out of his fucking mind here, you know?
Yeah.
And the elevator's door opens and it goes right into the bar, the elevator. And Wayne takes a few steps and sort of looks to the side and sees me in the red dress. doesn't bat an eye. And goes, "Hey, Jimmy, Heineken."
Didn't want to draw any attention.
Oh, fuck those! You know what we did one year, Russ, during the Christmas holidays. Speaking of Thanksgiving or holidays. It was either Thanksgiving or Christmas. And there's always check stops that are out. Okay. Back when people are around.
Yeah.
We would get one of those orange vests and a policeman's cap we'd find somewhere.
Oh, God.
We'd get a blow dryer, like a hair dryer. So it looked like a radar gun. And, and we would pull people over. Okay. Who are pulling up in front of the bar. And we'd jump out with this hair dryer. And go pull over, and they'd just be pissing themselves, freaking out, right? They're going, "Oh, my God." And they'd unroll the window, and we'd pull up with a tray of Zambuca and go,
"Oh, God."
Those are the days, Rusty, when you can have fun like that. Before we go, Rusty, I know you knew Teddy Green. You played at the same time. He was a coach. He's older than us. Teddy Green passed away this week. And one of the favorite lines that came out of Teddy Green. He was very funny. He was super tough. If you didn't know about Ted Green, you know, his most famous story was he got lumberjacked two-hander over the head and shattered his skull.
Jeez.
During a game, and he ended up with a plate in his head, and he went on to play and coach, and he was very much involved in the Oilers, and he died this week. But he was look him up. Look it up. Yeah. Google Teddy Green this week. But one of the best things ever, Rusty, and you and I love the lines, the one-liners, is when he was coaching, a kid got flattened, okay?
Yeah.
On his team. He got knocked out cold. Out fucking cold. And they got the smelling salts, and the medics are out there, the training staff, and they rub the smelling salt under his nose. It's right in front of the bench, and Teddy's looking at it. And they said, "Do you know who you are?" And Teddy goes, "Tell him he's Wayne Gretzky." Anyway, I knew Teddy, and I know you probably did too. I sure you had occasion to meet him.
I mean, I knew who he was, and I never played for him and stuff. But, of course, I know Teddy, and you could always hear him on the bench. 79 years of age, that's good life for
not bad.
Tough guy who broke his skull.
Yeah, he was a tough guy. When I think of him, I think of John Muckler. Okay, John Muckler, who's got his name on 5 or 6 Stanley Cups, is coach, assistant coach. And someone has said, ask Russ, should John Muckler be in the Hall of Fame? His last Stanley Cup final would have been, I think, as a general manager with this with the Ottawa Senators.
Yeah.
And so
he would probably would he fall under the builders? You know how they have the would he fall under that category? You know, like, I don't know. Coach, I guess that's because he didn't play, right? So he'd have to fall under the builders category.
He didn't play to any great level, I don't think.
No, so he'd be, yeah, I don't know how that, I don't know. Because I just focus on the players. And, you know, when I see the every year, the 4 people that get inducted into the Hall of Fame, and it's a girl and it's this guy who I've never heard of. And then I look for the hockey guys because, I mean, a lot of the times I don't know, unless it was a famous owner like Harold Ballard or the Wirt right. family or the Molsons. I mean, I don't know how that works. I really don't. I don't know, but
I would, my favorite episode is when I got all on my high horse and I could hear you that sitting there puffing away on your cigar, listening to me rant about Russ. There should be a category in the Hall of Fame for the guys who are the hardest workers, who played the most games, and they were the muckers. And I could just, you took your cigar, Jimmy, that guy should have his jersey, not in the Hall of Fame, but in his local fucking bar.
His Hall of Fame is the local bar. 100%. There's a few guys in the Hall of Fame that's where their jerseys should be.
That's right. Yeah,
they should be brought out there. We won't name names, but they, you know, like any club, there's always a few that get in that shouldn't be in.
That shouldn't be theirs, right? I'm going to scroll through here. As you think about this, someone's asking, where's the best city to eat? Where were the best nightclubs? I think we talked about this before, but...
I mean, the big cities now are all phenomenal. Food-wise, are just great. The food today is just amazing. Anywhere, but when I played, we ate at a lot of steakhouses, did the usual steak the night before a game or sushi. There's guys started eating sushi, a lot of sushi, which is probably healthier, but I don't know, Montreal and Toronto. Toronto, if you ever get to Toronto, you got to go to Yozo's in Yorkville.
There you go.
It's probably the best seafood restaurant I've ever eaten at. And I never experienced it until after my career. And I took Val Bure there when we were doing Battle of the Blades and he takes a bite of his entree and he goes, "Hey, Rusty, you know what we're doing tomorrow night?" And I go, "No, what are we doing tomorrow night?" He goes, "We're coming back here." We ate there 4 nights in a row.
We're going to, you spoke about the Moore incident last week, and I've had a lot of people weighing in on that.
Did they like what I said, or were they shitting on me?
Well, this guy, I think he's shitting on you.
Oh, yeah?
And I said, well, Rusty's never backed down from anything. As a matter of fact, if he was in a room, he would pick the guys who are shitting on him to deal with instead of the other guys who like him.
Yeah.
So anyway, just to back up, so, you know, Moore...
What did the guy say? Fuck it. I want to hear what he says.
Well, I want to give the story so when I ask you this question, people understand.
Well, hopefully they all listened last week so they know the question.
Right. Okay. So Moore does a dirty hit on Naslund, and the next game is coming up, and they got a sign on his head.
Yeah.
Right? On Moore's head. And in the end, he turned away from a fight, which you said was chicken shit, and then Bertuzzi chased after him and ended up clubbing him, hitting him in the back of the head. So it says, "Hey, Jim, I'd like to hear Rusty's take. So you called Moore and you think most players would call him a chicken shit, although he got terribly hurt in that thing."
Yeah, but he's not a chicken shit. He's a chicken shit because he didn't turn around and fight after he went after the best player. If you're gonna go after Wayne Gretzky, then you better freaking answer the bell. Then don't, if you're not going to answer the bell, then don't do it. And that's what my point was, I probably never had an elbowing penalty in my life or cross-checking because that was an invitation to scrap somebody. If you go after the best player on any team, then you better be prepared to answer the bell, not with that player, with whoever's going to come after you, because the whole team's going to come after you at some point, unless you're Wendell Clark or some big tough guy, then the tough guy's got to go after him. But anyways, my point was, if he's chicken shit because he did what he did and then didn't answer the bell when they came after him, he turned his back. So he's a pussy.
So this guy says, hey, Jim, I'd like to hear Rusty's take on how many times a player needs to answer the bell for a previous incident. Moore fought Cook earlier in that game. The absolute definition of chicken shit, as Russ described it, is punching a guy in the back of the head.
Well, you know, I...
Dun, 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 dun.
Well, the reason he got punched in the back of the head is because he didn't turn around. And if you watch Google the play, it started at the hash marks or the top of the circles, and it ended up, I believe, around center ice. So Bertuzzi was talking to him, going, let's go, let's go, let's go. And he ignored him. He should have turned around, like I said, and freaking hung on for dear life. And, but face the music. The fact that he didn't turn around was the reason he got punched in the back of the head. And too bad Bertuzzi didn't turn him around. And everybody wishes now he would have, because, you know, he probably would have, you know, just, he wouldn't have post-concussion syndrome. We wouldn't have a lawsuit. Right. If he had have been a man and frickin' turned around, dropped his gloves and hung on for dear life, which we all can. I've done it many times. Trust me, I've done it many, many times. And you can drop your gloves, pull yourself in tight or turtle or whatever. But the guy, I mean, I watched it. He just...
So as long as you do that, then you're not the chicken shit, does it?
Clovis Lemieux cross-checked, what's his name, in Detroit, and broke his face. And the next game, McCarthy, I think?
He played for Detroit.
Yeah, Detroit. They faced off, and Claude, who was a big, strong player, but not a fighter, really, dropped his gloves and answered the bell. I mean... That's what you do. He knew what he did was wrong, whether he'll admit it or not. But the next game, they wrote about it, they talked about it, and Claude Lemieux dropped his gloves and fought him. And that's what you do. And that guy didn't do it.
I agree.
And Matt Cook was a little shit disturber and not a tough guy. So if he thinks that fighting Matt Cook was answering the bell, give me a fucking break. Matt Cook was a little backstabbing piece of shit who didn't play the game the right way, in my opinion.
There we go. You know what? This is how we get more listeners, Russ. This is how we get more listeners.
Matt Cook wouldn't have played in the 80s because he would have got his ass kicked.
Right.
And he wouldn't have been able to play the way he played because of the rule, you know, like fucking... You can't play the way Matt played in the 70s and 80s. He got away with it because of the times, but he wasn't the tough guy to answer the bell. I mean, Moore was going to have to answer to somebody bigger and tougher and stronger than him.
Well, he probably got away with it because wasn't it right when the instigator penalty came in?
Yeah. And Matt's probably 180 pounds. I mean, come on.
I saw him making out on an airplane with a chick when I was flying back to Edmonton.
Really? Good for Matt.
I said, what the? God, is he ever small? Well, Rusty, that's another show in the books, pal. With all the burps that you had from the White Claw, okay?
Oh, did I have a lot of burps? Sorry.
This here? Yeah.
That's me exhaling my cigar.
Exhale it.
Hang on.
Okay.
That is not a burp. That is me blowing smoke.
No, you're a burp. You're a burper.
I apologize to everybody if I was burping. I didn't.
No, I like it. Keep it up.
Oh, fuck. I don't like it.
As we leave here, Russ, one of the funniest things I heard, and we might get into a joke of the day, right? You know me. I like to tell jokes. One of them was.
Let's hear one finally.
Okay, but Russ, the guy says, when you're born, Russ, you immediately start to use your brain 24/7 right up until the day you get married. Rusty, great job today. Very controversial. If you like the show, The Suspendables, that's who we are. We're on each and every week. You can listen to us on any podcast app. Check out globalstorynetwork.com. They're our partner in this thing. If you like it, do us a favor, listen, and let three or four more friends know.
How many listeners do we have now?
I don't know. I don't know. Last I heard, we were up over 60,000. So I don't know where we are. I'll get an update. I'll get an update, and we'll figure it out. Hopefully it's going up still. It will now with your take on Matt Cook. I fucking love that.
I wasn't a fan of the way Matt played.
Apparently not.
No,
yeah,
wasn't a fan.
Good. That's why we have you on here, Rusty. Unfiltered, Rusty Courtnell. Rusty, have a good week. Have a nice trip to New York.
All right.
I don't know how to exhale my cigar.
Uh-oh. Yeah, don't swallow those cigarettes.
Oh, take care, everybody. This is an awful job for the editor. We'll talk to you next week. We'll see you, Rusty.
See you, bud. You think I was too hard on Matt Cook?
No, fuck
God, me. I don't fucking hated fucking right. The way he played. Ugh.
So did I. You know, there's a funny... Did Maddie send you that... Maddie from Global Story send you... It's a hilarious email.
Oh, King Richard?
Yeah.
Wasn't that What? How did we bung his name up?
Well, I don't know him. I don't know him.
It's Richard Brodeur, right? So it's Richard Brodeur, and he was like, it's King Richard. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? So Gary Nyland plays with him. Gary Nyland plays with the Canuck alumni, even though he never played with the Canucks because he lives in Vancouver. He's a firefighter, great guy, played Toronto, Chicago. And so Richard comes up to him and says, my name's King Richard. And he goes, well, I only know one king, and his name's Boreas Selmick. Because Boreas' nickname was King.
Yeah, right.
King of Sweden and all that stuff.
Sure, sure. It says, it's King Richard Brodeur. I love you guys, and you bunked the king's name twice. He may be beefy, and the dude you want to stand by in the shower,
but he's a great guy or something.
Besides, but I still have the Vancouver Sun newspaper that states King Richard rules. Hell of a guy.
Yeah. So he wanted us to call him King, not a fucking.
Well, King now for
King Clancy?
King Clancy,
King Salming, but not King Richard.
Isn't the goalie in New York the king?
Well, because if you're from Sweden, right? Because they have a king and queen. If you're great, they call you king. I guess you know. But I went. I'll tell some Boreas Salming stories next.
Okay, episode. Yeah, save them.
Because all
I'm still recording, so maybe we can use some of this.
Well, yeah. Boreas, we'd go to the bar in Sweden during that 94-95 lockout with the Gretzky All Stars. We were in Stockholm, and we'd go into a bar and. He'd been retired for I don't know how long, and every bar he walked into, they started going, Boreas, Boreas, Boreas. I mean, it was unbelievable. It was like being with Gretz in Edmonton. I mean, it was crazy. Every bar we went to, Boreas, Boreas, was great.
Well, they drink vodka, man. They're good vodka drinkers. That's why. Mm. Okay, we're going to do another extra, Rusty. That's all for the show. We did two extras.
Okay. All right.
We're out of here.